Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show where we discuss a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Our topic today is a very important topic. It involves the emancipation not of some oppressed minority within our country, but about the emancipation of an oppressed majority, the majority of our people. I'm speaking, of course, of people of the female persuasion, who make up roughly 51% of the people in this nation. Well, it may come as a shock to some of you, but all you women out there for many years were at best second-class citizens within our country. And the struggle for women's rights, a struggle that goes on to this day in many respects, took form, took constitutional significance primarily through what's commonly called the women's suffrage movement. And of course, as you all know, that culminated in the adoption of the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote all the way back in 1920. A remarkably recent date when you think about it. Well, with me today to discuss the 19th Amendment and to profile some leading people, some leading women in that movement, is one of my now former students who's just recently graduated from the Appalachian School of Law. Her name is Michelle Caggiano. Hello, Michelle.
Hello.
Michelle has helped me before with an episode on religious freedom in the New York City mosque controversy, and she's going to be with me here today, and indeed she's going to be with me here again shortly. Now, why would I invite her back so many times? Is it because of her brilliance? Because of her friendliness? Well, all of those things, but also because this particular subject is one that we're going to devote more than one episode to. Now, let me tell you why. As perhaps some of you know, I have the honor of teaching not just at the Appalachian School of Law during most of the school year, but every summer for the past several summers, I also have the additional honor of teaching at the University of Tennessee College of Law. And I was recently speaking to one of my colleagues there. I'm asking him if perhaps he had something he'd like to talk about on the show. And he said, well, not really, but you need to talk to my wife. And I said, really? He said, yes, my wife. Her name is Wanda. Wanda Sobieski. Wanda is an expert on the 19th Amendment. Wanda, he said, has volunteered for years at the Tennessee Historical Museum right in downtown Knoxville, and she's the woman you need to talk to. Well, I took him up on his offer. I called up Wanda, and I had the most remarkable, in-depth, lengthy interview with her. It was an absolute delight. It was so delightful, so informative, that I just could not cut much of it. And so I've decided to give Wanda Sobieski the microphone, not just for one episode, but for two. And that's okay, because this is an extremely, extremely important subject, and one that I think you'll agree is absolutely fascinating. So first we're going to talk to Wanda Sobieski. After we talk to Wanda, we're going to talk to Michelle Caggiano about women's suffrage. Our first episode in the series is going to deal mostly with the origins of the women's suffrage movement, the early history, the national history, and then the second part of our women's suffrage coverage is going to deal with the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which came to its very dramatic conclusion right here in Tennessee. But first, let's talk a little bit about who Wanda Sobieski is. She is a lawyer. She is a very accomplished lawyer who's been practicing law in Knoxville for many years. She is a member of many different courts, bars. She was a graduate of the University of Tennessee Law School. She's argued a number of civil rights cases all the way up to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, typically, in Cincinnati. Lots of other important cases over the years. And as I said just a moment ago, also has a strong interest in Tennessee history, and specifically the history of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. I spoke to her just a few days before this broadcast, which is in the summer of 2011, and I spoke to her in her lovely, lovely offices in downtown Knoxville, which actually date to roughly the time that the 19th Amendment was passed. She works in a restored 1920s building full of brick and oak paneling. Used to be, believe it or not, a radio station in one of its earlier lives, and we sat in her conference room and talked about the 19th Amendment.
really the movement for women's rights and the vote for women in particular started with women who were largely Quakers, because the Quaker faith was more egalitarian than the other faiths.
That's interesting.
And most of them were also quite involved in the abolitionist movement. Earlier 1800s. And as a matter of fact, there's a story about Elizabeth Cady Stanton, one of the great writers for women's suffrage in its early days, and Lucretia Mott, who were both avid abolitionists, went to the International Abolition Convention in London. And they went as delegates after many years of work on the subject. And they were excluded from the convention solely because they were women.
Oh, good heavens, really?
And it became a real big issue, and there was a lot of debate about whether the women who had done all this work should be permitted to have a seat as a delegate. And finally, a compromise was reached, and they were allowed to attend if they sat in the balcony behind a veil and did not speak.
Good grief.
So they decided not to attend on those terms.
Now, what year was that, the abolitionist conference in
London?
That
would have been in about 1840, approximately. And so anyway, Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton chose instead to go for the walk, ignore the convention for a while. And they began to ruminate on the similarity in the legal condition of women and slaves. And they decided then they needed to do something that addressed the treatment of women. And so several years later, a few years later in 1848, at a tea party, they met with some friends and decided to call the Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls.
Okay.
And there was only a couple of weeks' notice. They really didn't expect many people to show up. The speakers were anticipated to be mostly men because women didn't speak in public back then. And they were really surprised when hundreds of people showed up for the convention. A lot of interest was generated.
Sounds like they'd struck a nerve there.
Apparently so. And then of course, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, having the sharp pen that she had, struck a bigger nerve when she wrote the Declaration of Sentiments. And she took the Declaration of Independence, basically, and rewrote it for women. We believe these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and then listed the grievances, just like the Declaration of Independence did, about women being denied the right to hold property. Women had no interest, legal interest, in their children. Their husbands could give them away without the woman's
permission.
See,
that is remarkable. I mean, the property stuff, I think most people are vaguely aware of, but the idea that a woman wouldn't actually have any legal right to custody of her children?
That's right.
That's extraordinary.
And the list was pretty long, but one of the demands that she made in that was the demand for the franchise, the vote. And that is, most historians say, is the first time there was a public demand for women having the right to vote. So when Elizabeth Cady Stanton presented her resolution to the convention, it sparked a lot of debate and a lot of concern, and a number of the women who had signed on originally as sponsors of the convention resigned because it was so outrageous for her to ask for women to vote.
So she was too radical even for her sisters.
Way too radical.
And these, of course, were self-selected people who were interested in women's rights.
Exactly.
Wow.
She was way, way out there. As a matter of fact, her husband, who was Henry Stanton, who was a well-known international abolitionist and reformist of various types, was said to have been so embarrassed by her demand that he left town for 3 weeks and refused to come home.
So, not the first spouse to be embarrassed by his spouse's activities, but that is a bit extreme. Yeah.
Yes, he was, and given his position in the world and his life work as a reformer,
it
really gives you an idea just how audacious her move was to ask for women to vote. And so that's the beginning, and it sparked ridicule all over the country. Newspapers all over the country got word of it, and they made fun of her and mocked her and began just a storm of criticism. And I suppose that probably gave her a pretty good hint she'd hit a nerve.
Right. Now, this was primarily or exclusively because of the demand for suffrage.
Yes.
Because of the voting rights. Other stuff was not as controversial.
No. There were concerns from different groups about different parts, but the big thing was women wanted to be in politics, and that would upset the social order. That would upset the political order, the economic order. It was just absolutely inconceivable. Religious forces lined up against suffrage because, women are supposed to be submissive, or because Eve took the apple, or whatever their particular religious belief was. By and large, most of the religious positions at the time were anti-suffrage.
Hmm.
Now, not all, and that certainly changed during the campaign, but in 1848, she stepped on a lot of religious toes as well.
Okay, and so maybe the only group that had any religious group that was on her side was maybe a bit of sympathy among the Quakers.
The Quakers were very, much more egalitarian, and so they didn't see it as an offensive move, by and large.
Okay.
And there were a few other smaller groups that were a little more egalitarian in their viewpoint, but a lot of the power of religion was used to oppose the movement toward women's suffrage. And a lot of, there were the kinds of arguments people made are what fascinated me.
Like what?
Well, if women had got the right to vote, then they would never get married again. And we'd never have any more children. It'd be the end of the human race.
So extinction was an argument.
Exactly.
Women's suffrage.
And women would be so busy at the polls, they would abandon their homes and their children, and men would have to raise the babies and feed them and take care of them and clean the houses, and women just wouldn't do anything anymore. And at the same time, they argued that women didn't want the vote, and so they wouldn't use it, so why give it to them? I mean, there were lots of inconsistent arguments, but by and large, there was an attack on an attempt to make women believe that they had to choose between family and a vote. And that's a tough position to be put in. Or that if they aligned themselves with these radical women, then no man would want to marry them. And they, they can't support themselves because they can't get good jobs. And at that time, most women couldn't even get an education. Public education was for men only.
I don't want to interrupt your narrative too much, but this is so reminiscent of the arguments I would hear in the 70s during the Equal Rights Amendment
exactly.
era. And I won't mention names, but I remember one middle-aged man who scoffed at the whole notion of women's equality. Said, the activists, these bra burners, they're just too ugly to get dates. They're too busy, that exactly. So the same sort of arguments being made.
Absolutely,
decades apart.
All the women who wanted suffrage were men haters, or
right.
they were, and if suffrage came, then men would become women, and women would become men, and there were
so
lots
the hermaphrodite
of,
argument.
Yeah.
Okay, we had extinction, and now we have the hermaphrodite argument.
There
okay.
were lots of postcards and other media that were used to campaign against suffrage that showed men dressed like women and women dressed like men, and women would start smoking,
right?
And they might wear pants.
Good heavens, not that!
And there were all sorts of claims that it would destroy the social order, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the movement progressed and gained steam, then there became a lot of economic interests that came into play, particularly because a lot of the suffragists also had been involved in the temperance movement.
Yeah.
The liquor industry started funding the opposition because the liquor industry didn't want women to get the vote and then pass prohibition.
Oh, okay. That's an interesting connection.
Stepped on them. They stepped on the manufacturers, or at least the manufacturers were afraid that women would step on them because they were pretty sure that if women got the vote, they would vote in child labor laws. And they would no longer have this cheap source of labor where
okay.
they put children in factories.
So if we give women the right to vote, the next thing we know, we'll have to protect children legally.
Yeah. Well, the women will take action or make us protect the children.
Okay.
And that would be an economic disadvantage to them. And so the manufacturers began to fund the opposition and began to fund the making of a lot of these arguments that don't really make a lot of sense, I don't think. But the manufacturers were a big industry. And then another, particularly in Tennessee, the railroads. were opposed to women having the right to vote.
Now, why did railroads particularly?
Well, because the railroads had so much power in the legislature, perhaps corruption, perhaps not, but so much power in the legislature, they feared that they would no longer have that much power if women came into the mix, and that they wouldn't be able to get to manipulate and control women to get...
That's interesting. You know, a lot of that just boils down to fear of changing the status quo.
Oh, sure.
And fear of the unknown, because certainly the opponents of suffrage were correct in one general sense, and that is that this would prompt some significant changes, societal changes, political
right.
changes, economic changes, and they were just perhaps incorrect in trying to always predict dire consequences.
Right.
You know, we don't know what the consequences would be, and that alone might have accounted for a fair amount of this opposition.
Well, that's there's a lot of fear. Mm-hmm. I think just generally, men feared what would happen in their household. And I suspect a lot of men didn't want to have to feed the babies or help with housework.
Oh,
or
yeah, and
again,
you bring it forward. I recall in college in the 1980s having discussions with young women, and people were very concerned at that point about, you know, if the women are going out and having careers, then who will take care of the children?
Exactly.
What will happen to family life? You
mm-hmm.
know, and these were subjects of discussion, and I imagine they still are today.
Well, these issues repeat themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, you can predict that they constantly repeat themselves. I mean, in World War II, when the men were sent off to war and the women went into the munitions factories and the other factories to support the war effort,
mm-hmm.
the men came home, the women got sent back home because the men needed the jobs.
Right.
And while it was patriotic and wonderful for the women to work in the factories when they were needed for the war effort, if they wanted to work outside the home after the war effort, then they were going to have juvenile delinquents. All
right.
the children would be juvenile delinquents because they'd be neglected by their parents. So, you know, there's always this kind of argument using the family to push whatever agenda, whether it's economic or social, people want to push, I guess.
Very interesting. Okay, well, we brought it up then to sort of the late 19th century.
Right.
And you have all of these forces arrayed now against suffrage for their various reasons. Who were the allies of the suffragists? I mean, they had to have somebody come in and help them.
Well, it was largely the women.
Just themselves.
There were some men's ratification groups, but most of them existed in name only. It was sort of, yes, you can use my name for
right.
what it's worth, but they didn't, for the most part, get out and actually do anything.
But there were no other industrial actors or institutional actors that felt that they were aligned with the women's suffrage movement?
No.
So
not that I'm aware of. Not
okay.
that I'm aware
okay.
of. So they did a lot of... And, of course, you got to remember, these are people who, at the beginning of the suffrage movement, couldn't even be treasurers of their own sewing clubs. They had to have a man do it.
They couldn't handle the money that was collected
yes.
to buy the yarn?
Right.
Or the needles? Okay.
Exactly.
Right.
And if a woman had a job and had a paycheck, her husband could go collect it. She
mm-hmm.
had no right to the paycheck. It belonged to her husband. So by and large, they didn't have access to money.
Hmm.
So a lot of the leaders were women who were independently wealthy, had wealthy families, were aristocratic types, which the leaders had then the time and the resources to be able to be involved. And the women who then eventually joined the movement, the middle-class women and women from other economic stratas, gave as much as they could give, but they didn't have the financial resources. I have a collection of pictures, of photographs from printed in various newspapers over the country of melting pot events, is what they called it, where the suffragists, local suffragists, would get together and melt down their jewelry to sell the gold, to get the money, to print the brochures that they handed out on the streets.
Good grief.
There were several women, including Lizzie Crozier French here in Knoxville, who had reasonable resources. She was from a wealthy or well-to-do family, who wound up broke at the end of their lives because they gave everything they had to the suffrage movement. And Susan B. Anthony, toward the end of her life, had tried so hard to get Rochester College integrated so that women could attend Rochester College. Finally worked out a deal with the trustees that trustees were opposed to integrating Rochester because they feared that their alums, a lot of them, would quit giving money. So they told her if she raised a certain amount of money, which was a fabulously large amount for the time, that if she raised that much, then they, by a certain deadline, then they would admit women. And she came within $2,000 or $3,000 of the mark, and they refused to give her an extension. They were, of course, keeping the money she raised.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and today we're discussing the women's suffrage movement that ultimately led to the passage and ratification of the 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution. When we return, we'll continue our discussion with Wanda Sobieski. Stay tuned.
She's good enough to be your baby's mother, and she's good enough to vote with you. Men plunge the world in war and sadness. She must protest in vain.
Once again, it's time for our constitutional quiz. I'm excited. I hope that you're excited, because I know that Kelly Carmichael is excited.
I'm always excited.
So am I, especially when it's time for our quiz. And also on the line is Maggie from Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Maggie, are you excited?
I am excited.
Well, then that's just great. But don't get so excited that you mess up, because remember, it's a very high-stakes quiz, and only if you answer the question correctly will you earn the T-shirt that says Your Weekly Constitutional across the front. So, Kelly, take it away.
All right, Maggie. Question for you today. Congress created a law that imposed a fine on any person that had ever owned a foreign car, even prior to the law. That would be a violation of the Constitution because it is A, Bill of Attainder, B, an ex post facto law, C, a violation of habeas corpus, or D, a tariff.
Wow.
Okay, can you repeat the first one again?
I can repeat the question again. Yes, so Congress created a law that imposed a fine on any person that had ever owned a foreign car, even prior to the law. If this happened, this would be a violation of the Constitution because it is A, a bill of attainder, B, an ex post facto law, C, a violation of habeas corpus, or D, a tariff.
Now, while Maggie's thinking about those answer choices, I'll have to say that if we were to pass a law penalizing possession of foreign cars, even retroactively, those of us who are originally from Detroit would think that would be a fine law. A fine law.
I did live in Michigan for a bit of time. And
you've given me an idea.
Accurate.
I'm going to write my congressman, and that's what we're, that will take care of those foreign car manufacturers. All right. So if we did a law like that, it would violate the Constitution, you say, for one of those four reasons. What are those four reasons again?
A, bill of attainder, B, ex post facto law, C, violation of habeas corpus, or D, a tariff.
Maggie? Give us your reasoning on this one. Why don't you go through the answers and tell us what you think?
Well, I'm pretty sure it's not habeas corpus, because that means produce the body. That's kind of irrelevant.
Okay, no body here to be produced. Okay.
No. And the first one was bill of retainer?
Bill of attainder.
Attainder. And I don't think that's right, because it just doesn't sound right. I think
that's good reasoning. Just doesn't sound right. Okay, absolutely.
I think the answer is B.
What is B again?
Ex post facto.
Ex
post facto law.
What does ex post facto mean?
I'm trying to remember, but something is making the bells go off in my head right now for that one.
Okay. Kelly? Is she on the right track?
She is. She earned her T-shirt today.
Yay! Yeah! We have a winner. Maggie, congratulations.
Yay. Thank you.
Ex post facto means very much what all those Latin scholars out there think it means. It means after the fact, making something illegal after the fact and penalizing people for something that was legal when they did it, but no longer is legal. And that's a favorite a favorite technique of tyrants, and our founders did not want that, did they?
This is true. And you know, going back to that example, if Congress were able to pass a law or ever would pass a law penalizing those who own a foreign car, it would be that law would only take effect for those moving forward, not in, you know, retrospective those who already own a currently own a foreign car. But I am convinced that this will never happen.
Yeah, and in fact, an interesting follow-up question would be whether such a law, even if only prospective, would be constitutional. But I'm not going to put that question to you right now.
But that's a good conversation for some of your law students.
Yeah, it would be very, and we may very well discuss that in the future. But for the moment, Maggie, you've done everything you needed to do. You have won the quiz, and so we will be getting a T-shirt to you in the very near future.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for playing.
Congrats, Maggie. Thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and now we're going to rejoin our discussion with attorney Wanda Sobieski, who is telling us about some of the difficulties encountered by early suffragists as they tried to work towards women's rights in other realms, such as co-education.
Wait a second.
But they weren't.
They said if you raise X dollars by this date, we will co-educate.
Right.
And she came that close. And they wouldn't give it an extension, but they kept all the money she'd raised.
But what she did was she turned in her life insurance policy so that when she died, she had to be buried by friends.
Mm.
The costs of her.
So she died a pauper.
Essentially, yes.
And wow.
I mean, that she was one of millions of women that did that had that kind of dedication. Lizzie Crozier French here was not a pauper, but she could have died a wealthy woman, and she did not, because she and her sisters and others gave so much of their time and effort and resources to the suffrage movement. So the women sort of rose up and did it on their own against.
And this was happening in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Yes.
Okay, now what actually, let's take it into the 19-teens and the, okay. Up to right up to the point. What actually turned the tide? Because you've only got women and they can't vote.
Right.
Okay, so the problem is they have to convince a bunch of men, in fact, a majority of men, in fact, a super majority of men all throughout the nation, pursuant to Article 5 of the Constitution, to amend the Constitution.
Exactly.
Why did they even think they had a prayer of doing this if there were no powerful other interests or men who were willing to help them?
They knew they were right. And they thought, and they many of the leaders honestly believed that just the purity of the argument, the fact that how can it be wrong? We're in a country that was founded because we didn't want taxation without representation. We tax the women. Give them a voice. Those were the kinds of arguments they believed.
Yeah, but
did it with the patriots' fervor.
Yeah, and I don't want you to think I'm arguing against suffragism, but I'm just trying to get a sense of the difficulty of this.
It was
because
overwhelming.
I mean, sure, on the one hand, this very idealistic argument, it makes a great deal of sense, it's just and all the rest of it, but hadn't they already seen that there were many examples of us treating different groups differently? I mean, this was this same era is often called the lowest point of race relations in our country. So, I mean, there were plenty of examples of inequality out there. So what made them think their arguments of fairness and equality would work when those of other groups had failed?
Well, it's interesting you'd mention race because black men were given the vote 50 years before women got it.
Yes.
And so I think there was hope. There was a notion that things were changing and should change.
Well, they were given the vote in the Constitution, but effectively they were denied the vote throughout most of the nation during the same period.
Well, I understand, but you have to start by making your national commitments to your philosophy and your Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And then you spend the rest of your life trying to live up to it and trying to make people live up to it. We have to enforce the Constitution today, and it was written many years ago. It's not like it changes the world on its own, but it's the commitment, it's the measuring stick. And if your bar is set so low below that for women, then they'll never get equality. And the same thing for men. And having that constitutional right was the springboard to bringing reality in line with it. And the women understood that too. They knew that just having the right to vote wasn't going to fix everything. and it wasn't going to be that easy. But they also knew that it was a starting point that was critical.
Okay. Wow. A lot of faith here. A lot of dedication by these women against overwhelming odds.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So what started turning the tide then?
Well, public opinion began to turn is part of it. And part of it is what was going on in the far west. Because in the pioneer states way out on the west coast, particularly the northwest, women had to work just like men to try to tame the land and to survive. And so we started having territories like Wyoming who formed letting women vote.
So Wyoming was the first.
And so when Congress wanted to bring Wyoming in as a state, that presented an issue of some controversy because Wyoming wanted the women to be able to vote in federal elections too, not just state elections.
Wow. Now, what year was Wyoming admitted?
Oh.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot. Roughly, give me a ballpark here.
It was in the late 1800s.
Okay, so that was an issue because Wyoming is out there.
Right.
And it already has suffrage for women. And when it comes in, it says, well, right. Half of our citizens can vote. We want them to vote in the National Union. That created a bit of an issue then.
And there was an issue in Congress about it. And Wyoming eventually basically said, we come in with our women voting or not at all.
Wow.
And so
did they?
So they did.
So Wyoming women could vote in national elections from...
Well, not exactly.
Okay, then.
they allowed them to continue to vote in the state elections. But they did not allow them in the federal elections until sometime later.
Okay.
So, and there was a belief that the whole issue of suffrage could be handled on a state-by-state basis. And as a matter of fact, that's really where most of the bigger suffrage organizations, national organizations, worked, was to get individual states to allow women to vote in their federal elections. And Wyoming did that very soon. And many of the northwestern states did. But the concern that the suffragists had was that it made no sense to say it's a state-by-state issue for women when it's a federal issue for men.
Mm-hmm.
And if women got their protection of their vote in the federal constitution, it'd be much harder to take it away from them. State legislatures tend to sort of flip-flop sometimes on their politics.
Right, and that is an important point constitutionally because, as you know, the Constitution, generally speaking, leaves voting qualification to the states.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a strong constitutional and traditional argument that this should be done on a state-by-state basis because all voting qualifications are done on a state-by-state basis. But as you point out, that means what the state giveth, the state can taketh away. And that's why the focus was on amending the national constitution.
Exactly. And when rights and privileges are given by the constitution, it's just much harder for the states to interfere with it. It's much harder to amend the constitution to take those rights away. And when we passed the constitutional amendments that followed the Civil War, many of them, and particularly the 14th Amendment, spoke in terms of citizens.
Right.
And that no rights and privileges of citizens could not be taken away.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, in 1872, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Avery Merriweather of Memphis, Tennessee, went to the polls during a federal election with the 14th Amendment in hand and convinced the poll workers that the 14th Amendment gave them the right to vote because they were citizens.
So they used the privileges or immunities clause
exactly.
of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment mm-hmm. to convince. So they were making a constitutional argument
to the poll workers.
To the poll workers, and I wonder if the poll workers really followed it or whether they finally just said, just let them vote. Just get them out of the line.
Well, Elizabeth Avery Merriweather says she's not sure they counted her vote.
Oh, okay, so they let them vote.
Okay, she was never sure.
Okay.
Susan B. Anthony voted,
mm-hmm.
but then again was arrested for her vote.
Ah.
And charged with voting illegally and stood trial for
mm-hmm.
it. And the judge directed a verdict of guilty against her.
Directed a verdict?
Directed a verdict.
He wouldn't even let the jury decide it.
No, and he would not let her testify because women back then weren't competent to testify in court.
Good grief.
So she couldn't even testify in her own defense.
Good grief.
And so he fined her. And she gave one of her famous speeches about not paying the fine in the courtroom then. But she was arrested for voting in 1872. And a lot of women watching that activity began to think about the 14th Amendment and what was going on with the black population, and really, really began pressing the notion that they were citizens too. And I think that really probably did give some real movement. Then, of course, in the early 1900s, World War I came about, and that slowed the movement again because there was a concern that any kind of criticism of the government
was unpatriotic.
It was unpatriotic, like the Civil War, too.
Yeah, that happens pretty much in every war.
Exactly. Yeah. But by 1916, 1917, during World War I, the women weren't ready to take the back seat again. They'd taken a back seat during the Civil War. They put their interests aside and during other conflicts that the United States had been involved in. But this time, a new, younger group of women, many of whom had watched what was happening in England with suffrage. The women there got it much faster than we did.
When did they get women's suffrage in England?
About 1915, I believe.
1915. These are pretty much simultaneous movements then.
Not really. They started much later. It was a faster movement.
So they started later and finished quicker. Okay.
Yes, they did. And they were much more militant. They threw rocks at Parliament.
Maybe that's what our women should have done. They just been thrown some rocks.
Well,
maybe
some
they
people
would have
thought about that. Let me tell you. There was, officially, the word is that there was only one shot that anyone can identify as fired in the battle for suffrage, and that was by a man who fired it into the ceiling at the headquarters of suffrage.
Some guy showed up at the suffrage
and
fired his shot. Okay, but other than that, it was a nonviolent movement.
It's very much a nonviolent movement.
Okay.
The government became violent about 1917, though, because in 1916 or so, Alice Paul broke away from, or I'm not sure broke away from is exactly the right term, but she formed her own little group called the Congressional Union, later known as the National Women's Party. And they had decided that the amendment had to be federal, that the larger suffrage organizations were not doing the best thing by trying to go state by state and pass these amendments state by state. And they had had hundreds of state conventions. I mean, it wasn't like you could go into the state and have one battle. And
they'd had some success, right? Out west, mostly?
They'd had some success in the north and in the west. There were failures in the south, obviously. But Alice Paul decided that they would pressure for a national amendment. And so she focused on the White House and on Congress. And their little group of women set up in a building that's right behind the Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C., as their headquarters. And they began lobbying Congress to pass an amendment. And when President Wilson was out giving his speeches during World War I about making the world safe for democracy and the beauty of democracy, they would take his words and put them on large banners and say, you know, essentially saying, not in these words, but that he's a hypocrite because he says that, but half of the people in his own country can't vote.
That's a rather compelling argument, making the world safe for democracy when you really don't have one at home.
Right. So they began picketing the White House with these banners.
And we've all seen those pictures.
You've seen those pictures and the arrests and the mistreatment of the women in the prison. Some of them were beaten. They were fed horrible, wormy food. It's just really bad, bad conditions. And ultimately became quite an embarrassment to President Wilson. Of course, by 1912... both the Republicans and the Democrats had put suffrage planks in their party platform.
We're talking to Knoxville attorney Wanda Sobieski, who has what seems to be an encyclopedic knowledge of the women's suffrage movement on both a national and a state level here in Tennessee. After the break, we'll come back and we'll have a profile by my former student, Michelle Caggiano, of one of the leading lights, actually two of the leading lights in the early women's suffrage movement, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. Stay tuned.
Our hearts have felt the glory of the coming of the time when the law and right and love and might shall make our land sublime. When the mount and hill and rock and rill with freedom's light will shine as truth comes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. Today we're talking about the 19th Amendment, which gave women in the United States the right to vote. And with me now is my former student, Michelle Caggiano, who is going to talk to us about two of the leaders of the women's suffrage movement, people you may have heard of, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi.
All right. Tell us about these remarkable women.
Well, I think we have to start with Stanton.
Okay.
She was born in November 1815 in okay. Johnstown, New York. And she kind of grew up with among wealth and actually had access to her father's law library.
Always a lawyer. In fact, yes. Was he a member of Congress, too, wasn't he?
He was, okay. Daniel Cady.
Okay.
And it was actually during, because she had this access, she also got access to the law clerks and was able to debate with them. And I think during that time is when she kind of got an idea of when the disproportion between men and women.
Right. Yeah. So, in fact, she also got her first taste of that when her older brother died, didn't she?
She did. She was 11 when mm-hmm. that happened, and she was in school, and she went to console her father, and her father basically told her, "I wish you were a boy."
Ouch. So. Ouch. Oh, man. And, what a thing to say to your daughter, that you wish she was a boy. But let's not be too hard on him. He was grieving. He was a man of his era, he did, after all, even despite having said that very hurtful thing to her, he did provide her with an education, which was unusual in those days for girls, right?
He did, and also, I mean, she went to a co-educational school,
right?
And so when she was younger and got to compete with boys and actually excelled a lot of times, was better than the boys that she was in school with.
Imagine that.
But when it come time to graduate, the boys went off to Union College, and she, which was where her brother had went to school,
uh-huh.
and she couldn't go. She
Ooh,
had to go to Troy Female Seminary, and she had told her dad that, you know, she would try to be everything that her brother would be. Or was. So,
mm-hmm.
so
very
I'm sure
interesting.
It was disappointing to her.
I'm sure it's very disappointing. Now, when she got out of school, she got involved in another movement that was very important in that era, wasn't it? It was the abolition movement?
She did. Once she graduated from Troy, she went to, she met her husband at that time. He, Henry Brewster Stanton.
Okay.
So, he was an abolitionist, and 2 days after they were married, they went to London for the convention, so the World Abolitionist Convention.
A working honeymoon.
It was.
All right. How was her assistance received by all these abolitionists?
Well, they were part of a delegation, and it actually didn't go over very well. The women had to sit, you know, behind a screen, so.
Ooh, ouch. Okay, so she showed up. She wants to abolish slavery, help oppressed people, and they oppress her.
Yes.
Okay, and that didn't sit very well, and what happened next?
Well, she actually met someone there, and that actually became her mentor, which was Lucretia Mott,
a very important person in the abolitionist movement.
Mm-hmm. And they ended up moving to Boston,
right?
And when they got back from London, and
right.
It was there that she actually got to rub elbows with some really important people.
Like who?
So, Garrison, for one.
Mm-hmm. William Lloyd Garrison, right?
Yes. Hawthorne, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Frederick Douglass, and Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Jeez Louise. It was like the all-star transcendentalist anti-slavery union.
Yes.
Okay.
And so it really drove her. She ended up having to move, though, to Boston, or excuse me, to Seneca Falls. So
that's familiar.
And she wasn't very happy there.
Right. So. But she did organize the famous Seneca Falls Conference, didn't she?
She did.
Which is typically dated as the beginning of the women's movement in the United States.
It is. And that's where she introduced her Declaration of Rights and Sentiments. And And the big controversy on that was the right to vote as well. So.
Yeah, which many of the delegates didn't actually support, which is remarkable to me. But, you know, I guess that was maybe just going a little bit too far. Now, what I'm interested in is, you know, you mentioned that she met Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison and all these other people. Was there a lot of overlap between the abolitionist movement and the women's rights movement at this time?
And there was, I mean, at the time, they were very supportive. The women were supportive of, you know, abolitionists, but as far as with the
men. Were the abolitionists also supportive of women's rights when it came time to actually amend the Constitution after the Civil War?
No.
They weren't?
No. When it came time, after the Civil War, with the 14th and 15th, Stanton actually caused a lot of controversy because she wasn't supportive of it, feeling that if men were the only ones that were allowed to vote, then that would be a vote against the women.
Oh, geez Louise. So there was a bit of a schism between the abolitionists and the women's rights after the Civil War.
Right.
That's too bad to hear, but I guess it's understandable. You're going to free the slaves and give them voting rights, but you're not going to do anything for women at the same time.
Right.
Is that where she was coming from? Okay. Well, after the Civil War, Anthony and Katie Stanton get together, and they're still, I mean, they've actually been together for a while now, but they form this partnership. Do either of them live long enough to see women get the vote?
No, they don't,
they
unfortunately.
Oh,
no.
Okay, when did they pass away?
Stanton passed away in 1902,
right.
October of 1902. In New York, and Anthony passed away March 13th, 1906.
Oh, that's a pity. Well, both of them, regardless of the fact that neither of them got to see women get the vote, they were both, of course, leading lights in that effort. And that's why Susan B. Anthony gets a dollar coin, and maybe one of these days Elizabeth Cady Stanton will be similarly memorialized.
We hope so.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michelle Caggiano.
Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and our discussion today is about the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. We've been talking to Knoxville attorney Wanda Sobieski, who's explaining to us that as of the election of 1912, both political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, at least allegedly, ostensibly, supported women's suffrage.
But they didn't really do anything to push for suffrage. And the Democrats were late to the party on the suffrage. The Republicans were the progressive party then.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republicans had really pushed, done more for suffrage. So Wilson was a Democratic president. So he had a platform with a plank, and he had all the right words, but he didn't use his political clout and influence to push for suffrage as much as Alice Paul and her group believed he should. So they began to really pressure him with the Silent Sentinels, then with the arrests. And some of their tactics were considered very controversial.
Oh, such as what?
Oh, well, they were charged. Some people said they were committing sedition.
Sedition.
Because
okay,
they
yes.
were criticizing the president during a war time. Mm-hmm. And they were just using his own words. Although some of the demonstrations spread into Boston and other areas, and women were arrested in several cities ultimately, they did burn Wilson in effigy, which was...
That's rather provocative.
That became a
did
big
they do that
issue.
Right out in front of the White House?
No, it was in Boston.
It was in Boston, okay.
Anyway, there were a number of arrests, and the women were badly treated, and not well charged, as it turns out.
Now, was that reported at the time? I mean, were there press reports about the bad treatment?
There was some press reports, but not a lot. It was hard to get word out of the prison and through the prison. But as the women got released from prison, they got formed what they called the jail train and jail for freedom train, and they took the train all the way across the northern states. And whistle stops told everybody who would listen about what happened to them.
Well, you kind of wonder then whether the rather aggressive mistreatment of these suffragists was actually backfired then.
It certainly did.
Yeah.
They sent Maud Younger into the South. This is one of the great ironies. You know, the South was pretty solidly anti-suffrage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's why I admire the women of Tennessee who stood up for suffrage, because it was more difficult to be a suffragist in Tennessee than it was in New York or Wyoming or some of the other places. But Maud Younger came into Tennessee and went all across the state with the stated purpose to have public meetings and inform everyone about how the women were being treated.
Hmm.
And the Tennessee Bar Association didn't like that, so they tried to get the cities and mayors not to give the women permits for meetings and not to give them
hotels. The Tennessee Bar Association, the lawyers of the state, and I imagine you're a member of that same Bar Association today. So your Bar Association was allied with the anti-suffragists.
Well, some members. I don't know that it was ever taken as a formal and official action, but members of the bar got together in the various cities and tried to stop Maud Younger's appearance. And Knoxville was a wonderful example. Maud came through here in November of 1917. And so some of the prisoners had been released. There were still women picketing the White House every day. There were still people accusing the suffragists of committing sedition by criticizing the president or criticizing the government or whatever they thought they were criticizing. So Maud came to Tennessee and came to Knoxville and had reserved the Market House to do her speech in. But by the time she got here, the permission to use the Market House had been withdrawn.
Mysteriously withdrawn.
So she found a friendly lawyer who thought that he could arrange for her to use the courthouse, one of the courtrooms. And so he went to see Judge Trotter, who was a criminal judge at the time, who had at one time had control of the courthouse somehow, of the use of the courthouse administratively. And anyway, he no longer had control. A county commission did. It had three commissioners on it. So she went to county commission to try to get permission, and Lizzie Crozier French, our local person, was helping her. County commission was afraid of the sedition argument, and so Maud offered to let them censor her speech. She would give it to them in advance, and she did, and so they could see that it really was not a seditious speech. They were just encouraging President Wilson to do what he knew was right. So she.
That's an interesting tactic, because of course most people would never want to be censored. But if the alternative is not being able to speak at all,
exactly.
And if your point is we're not actually committing sedition,
right?
Well, that was actually a pretty interesting tactic.
Right.
And did that work for her?
Yes, it did. She convinced the commissioners and even the county attorney, who had been very much opposed to her speaking, that she had a good point and that they should give her the courtroom. And so she scheduled her meeting, and it was late November. It was cold and windy and, you know, sort of an ugly November. And but when they got, so they sent out notices. When they got to the courthouse that night, they couldn't get in because the sheriff had decided to bar them from the courthouse.
Man.
And so there were armed sheriff's guards.
Did he just do that on his own?
Locking the women, yes. He decided that he should be in charge of the courthouse and take control of it. So the women could not get inside. So she stood on the steps of our old courthouse down here on the corner of Gay and Main, I guess it is. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, the sheriff has the building, but I have the audience. And she gave her speech from the steps while people stood there and shivered but listened.
Wow. Quite determination. And again, you wonder if these tactics just backfire, because every time somebody tries to shut her down, there's just that much more publicity and maybe even that more outrage from people who might not be in favor of suffrage, but who are simply fair-minded.
Well, there were two things that happened. The labor hall heard about this going on, and they decided it was a First Amendment issue.
They cared about the fact that she was being silenced, not so much about suffrage. Right.
So they hadn't particularly aligned themselves with suffrage, but they came down to protect her from the sheriff, so they were out there with armed men protecting her.
So they're finally getting some allies.
And then The ironic part of it is the whole speech, which was primarily about the treatment of the pickets and why they were picketing and so forth, played on the chivalry of Southern men. Because the thought that the government was mistreating women like that, in that sort of physical and grotesque way, offended men, and many of them became supporters of suffrage. Because they were mad at the treatment the women got.
Well, you know, you make the arguments that will appeal to your audience, right? If you have to appeal to chivalry, then by golly, that's what you do.
And it yeah. it worked. It okay. Obviously,
I was wondering how you'd ever get men in the South, and you know, no dig at the South, but the, you know, the, right. the attitudes here were a lot more anti-suffrage.
Right.
But that was the way to the men's hearts: is don't mistreat our women.
That was a part of it, certainly.
Okay, and well, that's interesting.
That came a long way. So there we are. That's late 1917. Well, in 1919, Congress approved the amendment and voted it out to the states. So
that is just remarkable. And again, it's just you think this is just a gradual change in attitudes, and not just because of all this public stuff we've been talking about, but I imagine there were just millions and millions and millions of private conversations between husbands and wives and sisters and brothers and daughters and dads.
Right.
And that's there was a lot of insistence by a lot of women, and I think a lot of men just eventually saw the light.
And one of the tactics that they used was, one of my favorite tactics that they used was parlor meetings.
Parlor meetings.
The suffragists couldn't, they, you know, certain times during the struggle, which is actually most of the time during the women's movement for suffrage, they couldn't speak in public, and they couldn't, they really weren't supposed to be political or talk about politics and so forth. So they would have teas and parties and invite their friends over and sewing circles, and some of the suffrage groups called themselves circles, so it'd be more acceptable. And then they would put on little plays and read poetry that was written about suffrage and about suffrage themes. And that's how they persuaded their neighbors and their friends
right.
to start thinking about the legal position of women. And I've got some of the plays and poems, and some of them are really, really delightful.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, you had a lot of grassroots activity going on. Then you had the National Women's Party, the Congressional Union, doing extensive lobbying in Washington, D.C. You'd had hundreds of campaigns out in the states, and some of the states voting for suffrage. So it there's a lot of activity. Then Congress passes the amendment out in 1919.
Okay, I have to stop you because I have to ask. Now, of course, prohibition was also moving forward at this time.
Prohibition passed before suffrage did.
Right, but I mean, it's roughly the same time, right?
Right.
I mean, it's late teens, right?
Right.
We're talking about this now. I'm wondering then, you said before that a lot of women were at least assumed to be in favor of prohibition. Did
right.
the pro-prohibition forces therefore become pro-suffrage forces in order to, if not get prohibition enacted, at least, you know, cement it or cement support for it?
I'm not sure how to answer that. I can tell you that a lot of the people who were for prohibition were for suffrage. They went hand in hand a lot. And part of that was because of the divorce laws. Women couldn't get divorced.
Right.
So women who had abusive, alcoholic husbands couldn't get divorced. Some people saw the solution as controlling the liquor.
I see.
And some people saw the solution as change the laws so women could get divorced.
Okay.
And women could leave a drunken husband. So, but that was the intersection where the two groups
right.
met a lot, was on the issue of women not being able to get free
right.
from.
So, but prohibition was voted in first, so we can't say that the prohibition movement first got women to vote and then got prohibition. It was actually the opposite. But
correct.
Nonetheless, there was a lot of overlap between the two groups, and,
right.
and maybe a prohibitionist who wanted to cement prohibition thinks, you know, he wants more allies, and he thinks he's going to get more allies
that
with female
be.
Vote.
That
votes.
Could be.
Well, anyway, that's an interesting intersection chronologically and sociologically
right.
and so on. Okay.
And that's about all the time we have. But don't worry, we'll resume. We'll pick up our conversation on the 19th Amendment during our next episode. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.